I don't like the look of this, Mr. Fraser.
No, sir. Let's have a word with these fellows. Mallory crossed the street. He accosted a squat, veiny-nosed sand hog who was bawling at the crowd and forcing leaflets upon them.
What's the trouble here, Brother Sapper?
The sand hog looked Mallory up and down and grinned around an ivory toothpick. There was a large gold-plated hoop in his ear, or perhaps real gold, as the Brotherhood was a wealthy union owning many ingenious patents.
I'll give you the long and short of it, mister, since you ask so civil-like. 'Tis the goddamn bloody hare-brained pneumatic trains. We told Lord Babbage in petition that the bleeding tunnels never would air proper, but some spunking bastard savant give us some fucking nonsense lecture, and now the bastard things have gone sour as rotten piss.
That's a serious matter, sir.
You're fucking right it is, Cove.
Do you know the name of the consulting savant?
The sandhog talked the question over with a pair of his helmeted friends.
Lordship name of Jeffreys.
I know Jeffreys, Mallory said, surprised. He claimed that Rudwick's pterodactyl couldn't fly. Claimed he'd proven it a torpid, gliding reptile that couldn't flap its own wings. The rascal's an incompetent. He should be censured for fraud.
Savant yourself, are you, mister?
Not one of his sort, Mallory said.
What about your pal, the fucking copper here?
The sandhog tugged agitatedly at the ring in his ear.
Wouldn't be taking all this down in your bleeding notebooks, would ye?
Not at all, Mallory said with dignity. Simply wanted to know the full truth of the matter.
You want to know the bloody truth, you savant ship? You'll crawl down there and scrape yourself a bucketful of that mouldy shite off the bricks. Sewer men of 20 years standing are tossing their guts from the stink.
The sandhog moved to confront a woman in banded crinoline.
You can't go down there, darling. Ain't a single train rolling in London.
Mallory moved on.
We haven't heard the last of this, he muttered aloud, vaguely in Fraser's direction. When a savant takes on industrial consultation, he needs to be sure of his facts.
It's the weather, Fraser said.
Not at all. It's a matter of savantry ethics. I got such a call myself. Fellow in Yorkshire wants to build a glass conservatory on the pattern of Brontosaurus spine and ribs. The vault work is fine and efficient, I told him, but the glass seals will surely leak. So no job and no consulting fee, but my reputation as a scholar is upheld.
Mallory snorted on the oily air, cleared his throat and spat into the gutter.
I can't believe that damned fool Jeffreys will give Lord Babbage such poor advice.
Never saw any savant talk straight to a sandhog.
Then you don't know Ned Mallory. I honour any honest man who truly knows his business.
Fraser considered this. He seemed a bit dubious, if one could judge by his leaden expression.
Dangerous working-class rioters, you sandhogs.
A fine radical union. They stood stoutly by the party in the early days and still do.
Killed a deal of police in the time of troubles.
But those were Wellington's police, Mallory said.
Fraser nodded somberly. There seemed little help for it but to walk all the way to Disraeli's. Fraser, whose long-legged, loping stride matched Mallory's with ease, was nothing loath. Retracing their steps, they entered Hyde Park, Mallory hoping for a breath of fresher air. But here the summer foliage seemed half-wilted in the oily stillness, and the greenish light beneath the boughs was extraordinary in its glum malignity. The sky had become a bowl of smoke, roiling and thickening. The untoward sight seemed to panic the London starlings, for a great flock of the little birds had risen over the park. Mallory watched in admiration as he walked. Flocking activity was a very elegant lesson in dynamical physics. Quite extraordinary how the systematic interaction of so many little birds could form vast, elegant shapes in the air, a trapezoid, then a lopped-off pyramid, becoming a flattened crescent, then bowing up in the centre like the movement of a tidal surge. There was likely a good paper in the phenomenon. Mallory stumbled on a tree root. Fraser caught his arm.
Sir.
Yes, Mr. Fraser.
Keep an eye peeled, if you would.
We might perhaps be followed. Mallory glanced about him. It was not much use. The park was crowded, and he could see no sign of the coughing gent or his derbied henchman. On Rotten Row, a small detachment of Amazon cavalry. Pretty horsebreakers, they were called in the papers, this being a euphemism for well-to-do courtesans, had gathered about one of their number, thrown from her side-saddle by her chestnut gelding. Mallory and Fraser, as they came closer, saw that the beast had collapsed and lay frothily panting in the damp grass by the side of the trail. The rider was muddied but unhurt. She was cursing London and the filthy air, and the women who had urged her to gallop, and the man who had bought her the horse. Fraser politely ignored the unseemly spectacle.
"Sir, in my line of work we learn to cultivate the open air. There are no doors ajar or keyholes about us at the moment. Will you inform me of your troubles in your own plain words, as you yourself have witnessed the events?"
Mallory tramped on silently for some moments, juggling the matter in his mind. He was tempted to trust Fraser. Of all those men in authority whose aid he might have sought in his troubles, this sturdy policeman alone seemed primed to boldly grapple problems at their root. Yet there was much hazard in that trust, and the risk was not to himself alone.
"Mr. Fraser, the reputation of a very great lady is involved in this affair. Before I speak, I must have your word as a gentleman that you will not damage the lady's interests."
Fraser walked on with a meditative air, hands clasped behind his back.
"Ada Byron?" he asked at length.
"Why, yes. Oliphant told you the truth, did he?"
Fraser slowly shook his head.
"Mr. Oliphant is very discreet, but we of Bow Street are often called upon to put the muzzle on the Byrons' family difficulties. One might almost say that we specialize in the effort."
"But you seem to know almost at once, Mr. Fraser. How could that be?"
"Sad experience, sir. I know those words of yours. I know that worshipful tone. The interests of a very great lady."
Fraser gazed about the gloomy park, taking in the curved benches of teak and iron, crowded with open-collared men, flush-faced women fanning themselves, wilted hordes of city children gone red-eyed and peevish in the stinking heat.
"Your duchesses, your countesses, they all had their fancy mansions burnt down in the time of troubles. Your rad ladyships may put on airs, but no one calls them great ladies in quite that old-fashioned way, unless referring to the Queen herself, or our so-called Queen of Engines."
He stepped carefully over the small feathered corpse of a starling, lying quite dead in the gravelled path, with its wings spread and its small wrinkled claws in the air. A few yards on, the two slowed to pick their way through a score of them.
"Perhaps you'd best start at the beginning, sir. Start with the late Mr. Rudwick and that business."
"Very well."
Mallory wiped sweat from his face. His kerchief came away dotted with specks of soot.
"I am a doctor of paleontology. It follows that I'm a good party man. My family is somewhat humble, but thanks to the Rads I took a doctorate, with honours. I loyally support my government."
"Go on," Fraser said. "I had 2 years in South America, bone digging with Lord Loudon, but I was not a leading savant on my own account. When I was offered the chance to lead my own expedition, generously financed, I took it. And so, I later learned, did poor Francis Rudwick, for similar reasons."
"You both took the money of the Royal Society's Commission on Free Trade."
"Not merely their financing, but their orders, Mr. Fraser. I took 15 men across the American frontier. We dug bones, of course, and we made a great discovery, but we also smuggled guns to the Redskins to help them keep the Yankees at bay. We mapped routes down from Canada, taking the lay of the land in detail. If there's war between Britain and America some day..."
Mallory paused.
"Well, there's an almighty war in America already, is there not? We are with the Southern Confederates in all but name."
"You had no idea that Rudwick might be in danger from these secret activities?"
"Danger? Of course there was danger, but not at home in England. I was in Wyoming when Rudwick was killed here. I knew nothing of it till I read of it in Canada. It was a shock to me. I fought bitterly with Rudwick over theory, and I knew he had gone to dig in Mexico, but I didn't know that he and I had the same secret. I didn't know that Rudwick was a commissioned dark lantern man. I only knew that he excelled at our profession."
Mallory sighed on the foul air. His own words surprised him. He had never fully admitted these matters even to himself.
"I rather envied Rudwick, I suppose.
He was somewhat my elder, and he was a pupil of Buckland's."
"Buckland?
One of the greatest men of our field. He's gone now as well, but truth to tell, I didn't know Rudwick well. He was an unpleasant man, haughty and cold in his relations. He was at his best exploring overseas at a good distance from decent society."
Mallory wiped the back of his neck.
"When I read of his death in a low brawl, I wasn't entirely surprised at the manner of it."
"Do you know if Rudwick ever knew Ada Byron?"
"No," Mallory said, surprised. "I don't know. He and I were not that highly placed in savant circles, not at Lady Ada's level, certainly. Perhaps they were introduced, but I think I should have known it had she favoured him."
"He was brilliant, you said.
but not gallant.
Fraser changed the subject.
Oliphant seems to believe that Rudwick was killed by the Texians.
I don't know about any Texians, Mallory said angrily. Who knows anything about Texas? A damned wilderness, seas and continents away. If the Texians killed poor Rudwick, I suppose the Royal Navy should shell their ports in reprisal, or something of the sort.
He shook his head. The whole foul business, which had once seemed so daring and clever to him, now seemed something inglorious and vile, little more than a low cheat.
We were fools to get involved in the Commission's work, Rudwick and I. A few rich lords scheming in camera to harass the Yankees. The Yankee republics are already tearing at each other's throats over slavery or provincial rights or some other damned foolishness. Rudwick died because of that, when he might be alive now and digging up marvels. It makes me ashamed.
Some might say it was your patriotic duty, that you did it for the interests of England.
I suppose so, Mallory said, shaking himself.
But it's a great relief to speak out on the matter, after so long a silence.
Fraser did not seem much impressed by the story. Mallory surmised it was an old and tiresome tale to Inspector Fraser of the Special Branch, or perhaps a mere fragment of larger and more shadowy misdoings. But Fraser did not pursue the matter of politics. He confined himself to the facts of crime.
"Tell me about the first attack on your own person."
"Well, that came at the Derby. I saw a veiled lady within a hired cab, treated dreadfully by a man and woman, whom I took to be criminals. The woman being one Florence Russell Bartlett, as I presume you know."
"Yes, we are searching most vigorously for Mrs. Bartlett."
"I could not identify her male companion, but I may have overheard his name, Swing, or Captain Swing."
Fraser seemed a touch surprised.
"Did you tell that fact to Mr. Oliphant?"
"No," Mallory, feeling himself on thin ice, said nothing more.
"Perhaps that's just as well," Fraser said after a thoughtful pause. "Mr. Oliphant's a bit fanciful at times. And Captain Swing is quite a famous name in conspiracy, a mythical personage much like Ned Ludd, or General Ludd. The Swing Bands were Luddites of the countryside years ago, arsonists mostly, rick burners. But in the time of troubles they grew savage, and killed a deal of the landed gentry and burned down their fine mansions." "Ah," said Mallory, "do you think this fellow is a Luddite, then?"
"There are no more Luddites," Fraser said calmly. "They're as dead as your dinosaurs. I rather suspect some mischievous antiquary. We have this fellow's description, we have our methods. When we take him, we'll quiz him on his taste in false identities."
"Well, this fellow's certainly no rural labourer. He's some sort of Frenchified racetrack dandy. When I defended the lady, he went for me with a stiletto, nicked me in the leg. I suppose I'm lucky that the blade was not venomed."
"Perhaps it was," Fraser said. "Most poisons are far less potent than the public supposes.
Well, I knocked the rascal down and drove them off from their victim. The tout swore twice that he would kill me. Destroy me was the word he used. Then I realized that the lady could be only Lady Ada Byron. She began to talk in a very strange manner, as if drugged or frightened witless. She begged me to escort her to the royal enclosure, but as we approached the royal box, she escaped me by a trick, without so much as a word of thanks for my pains."
Mallory paused, fingering the contents of his pockets.
"I suppose that's the gist of the matter, sir. Shortly after, I won a good deal of money, wagered on a steam gurney built by a friend of mine. He gave me very useful information, and it changed me, in a moment, from a modest scholar to a man of means."
Mallory tugged his beard.
"Great as that change has been, it seemed much the lesser wonder at the time."
"I see."
Fraser walked on silently. They approached Hyde Park Corner, where men stood on soapboxes, haranguing the crowd and coughing. Fraser and Mallory fell silent as they walked among the clumped and sceptical listeners. They crossed the frantic, crackling bustle of Knightsbridge, Mallory waiting for Fraser to speak, but the policeman said nothing. At the tall iron gates of Green Park, Fraser turned and watched the street behind them for a long moment.
"We can cut short through Whitehall," he said at last. "I know a back way."
Mallory nodded. He followed Fraser's lead. At Buckingham Palace the guard was changing. The royal family, as was their habit, was summering in Scotland, but the elite brigade of guards carried out the daily ritual in the Queen's absence. The palace troops proudly marched in the very latest and most efficient British military gear, dun-coloured Crimean battle garb, scientifically spattered to deceive the enemy eye. The clever fabric had utterly confused the Russians, by all accounts. Behind the marchers, a team of artillery horses towed a large military calliope, its merry piping and rousing drones sounding strangely forlorn and eerie in the still, foul air. Mallory had been waiting for Fraser to reach a conclusion. At last he could wait no longer. "Do you believe I met Ada Byron, Mr. Fraser?" Fraser cleared his throat and spat discreetly.
"Yes, sir, I do. I don't much like the matter, but I don't see much to marvel at in it."
"You don't?"
"No, sir. I believe I see the root of it clear enough. It is gambling trouble. Lady Ada has a modus."
"A modus? What is that?"
"It is a legend in sporting circles, Dr. Mallory. A modus is a gambling system, a secret trick of mathematical enginery to defeat the odds-makers. Every thieving clacker wants a modus, sir. It is their philosopher's stone, a way to conjure gold from empty air."
"Can that be done? Is such an analysis possible?"
"If it is possible, sir, perhaps Lady Ada Byron could do it."
"A friend of Babbage," Mallory said.
"Yes, I can believe it.
Indeed I can.
Well, perhaps she has a modus. Perhaps she only thinks she does," Fraser said. "I'm no mathematician, but I know there's never been any betting system that worked worth a damn. In any case, she's blundered into something nasty again."
Fraser grunted in disgust.
"She's pursued that clacker's phantom for years now, and rubbed shoulders with very ugly company. Sharpers, low clackers, loan makers, and worse. She's amassed gambling debts to the point of open scandal."
Absently, Mallory hooked his thumbs within his money belt.
"Well, if Ada's truly found a modus, she won't have debts much longer."
Fraser offered Mallory a look of pity for such naivety.
"A true modus would destroy the institutions of the turf. It would wreck the livelihood of all your sporting gents. Ever seen a track crowd mill up about a Welsher? That's the sort of stir a modus would bring. Your Ada may be a great blue stocking, but she hasn't any more common sense than a housefly."
"She's a great savant, Mr. Fraser. A great genius. I've read her papers, and the superb mathematics.
Lady Ada Byron, Queen of Engines," Fraser said, in an utterly leaden tone that had more weariness than contempt. "A strong-minded woman, much like her mother, eh? Wears green spectacles and writes learned books. She wants to upset the universe and play at dice with the hemispheres. Women never know when to stop."
Mallory smiled. "Are you a married man, Mr. Fraser?"
"Not I," Fraser said.
"Nor I, not yet. And Lady Ada never married. She was a bride of science."
"Every woman needs a man to hold her reins," Fraser said.
"It's God's plan for the relations of men and women." Mallory scowled. Fraser saw his look and thought the matter over again.
"It's evolution's adaptation for the human species," he amended.
Mallory nodded slowly. Fraser seemed markedly reluctant to meet Benjamin Disraeli, making some brief excuse about watching the streets for spies. But Mallory thought it far more likely that Fraser knew Disraeli's reputation and did not trust the journalist's discretion. And small wonder. Mallory had met many men of affairs in London, but Dizzy Disraeli was the Londoner's Londoner. Mallory did not much respect Disraeli, but he did find him amusing company. Disraeli knew, or pretended to know, all the backstage intrigues in the Commons, all the rows of publishers and learned societies, all the soirées and literary Tuesdays at Lady So-and-so's and Lady This-and-that's. He had a sly way of alluding to this knowledge that was almost magical. Mallory happened to know that Disraeli had in fact been blackballed at 3 or 4 gentlemen's clubs, perhaps because, although a professed and respectable agnostic, Disraeli was of Jewish descent. But the man's modes and manners somehow left the invincible impression that any Londoner who did not know Dizzy was an imbecile, or moribund. It was like a mystic aura, a miasma that surrounded the fellow, and there were times when Mallory himself could not help but believe it. A female servant in mob cap and apron showed Mallory in. Disraeli was awakened, eating his breakfast, strong black coffee, and a stinking platter of mackerel fried in gin. He wore slippers, a Turkish robe, and a tasselled velvet fez.
"Morning, Mallory! Dreadful morning! Beastly!"
"It is, rather." Disraeli crammed the last of his mackerel into his mouth and began to stuff the first pipe of the day.
"Actually, you're just the fellow I need to see today, Mallory. Bit of a clacker, technical expert."
"Oh?"
"New damned thing. I bought it just last Wednesday. The shopman swore it would make life easier."
Disraeli led the way into his office, a room reminiscent of Mr. Wakefield's office in the Central Statistics Bureau, though far less ambitious in scale and littered with pipe dottles, lurid magazines, and half-eaten sandwiches. The floor was crowded with carved blocks of cork and heaps of shredded excelsior. Mallory saw that Disraeli had bought himself a Colt and Maxwell typing engine and had managed to haul the thing out of its packing crate and set it upright on its curved iron legs. It squatted on the stained oak boards before a patterned office chair.